Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents What Do Bees Think About? By Mathieu Liorot. Translated by Alison Duncan. Narrated by Elliot Fitzpatrick. Series Editor's Foreword. Ethology is fascinating in many ways. Each species we study opens the door to a new world. But there are worlds so different from ours that they're beyond comprehension. Like navigators in search of unexplored continents, some scientists take up the challenge. Mathieu Liorot is one of them. Expanding our understanding of animal intelligence, he urges us to have greater respect for insects. His journey to the heart of a miniature world captivates as much as it challenges our certainties. Some illustrious people before him had already begun to unravel the mysteries of these tiny creatures. Of all the insect societies that have been studied, none is more fascinating than that of bees. While in his History of Animals, Aristotle does not attribute logos to animals, he does grant these social hymenopterans a remarkable intelligence that is superior to that of certain blood animals. Footnote. According to Aristotle, logos is unique to human beings. Broadly speaking, it characterizes the distinct nature of human communication and community. According to him, the bee colony is a model for human political organization, which through careful study can shed light on the functioning of human societies. In those ancient times when male dominance prevailed, scholars attributed the regency of the colony to a king bee and reasoned that the workers' incessant activity and division of labor had to be dictated by a male. Centuries later, and it was discovered that the winged monarch was in fact a queen who didn't govern the workers, and that these workers had different functions during the course of their lives. For Pliny the Elder, the divine bees are patient of fatigue, toil at their labours, form themselves into political communities, hold councils together in private, elect chiefs in common, and, what is most remarkable of all, have their own code of morals. And therefore, if the king should happen to be carried off by the pestilence, the swarm remains plunged in grief and listless inactivity. It collects no more food and ceases to issue forth from its abode. The only thing that it does is to gather around the body and to emit a melancholy humming noise. Greco-Roman philosophy wasn't the only tradition to see a model of virtue in this noble insect. The bee is a key animal in the biblical bestiary, and embodies the heart of work, devotion, and merit. The theologian Gregory of Nyssa used the bee as a metaphor to illustrate the work of the priests gathering the scriptures. In these words, Proverbs counsels that one should not depart from any of the good teachings, but, flying to the grassy meadow of the inspired words, should suck from each of them something that assists the acquisition of wisdom, and make oneself into a honeycomb, storing the fruit of this labour in one's heart, as in some beehive, fashioning for the manifold teachings separate storage places in the memory, like the hollow cells in a honeycomb. More than mere earthly food, the bee provides a spiritual provender. Seen as immaculate and a symbol of chastity, the queen, who is capable of reproducing without the help of a male, fascinates the defenders of virginity dogma. In their remarkable book, L'abbé et le philosophe, étonnant voyage dans la ruche des sages, The Bee and the Philosopher, a surprising journey into the wisdom of the colony, the brothers Pierre-Henri and François Tavoyot explain that, like a mirror of humanity, the bee has been a symbol of different ideological issues. It was seen as libertarian and mutualist by the anarchist Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, as industrial by the economist Henri de Saint-Simon, and as the symbol of communism opposed to commercial liberalism, by the French president, Adolphe Thiers. Rather than seeing the bee colony as a metaphor for humanity, Mathieu Lihoreau has stepped into the head of this royal insect. And the change in perspective is astounding. Elements that were visible to us disappear, and others become more salient because they have an important biological significance. In the bees' realm, some of them smell the fragrance of flowers at their leisure, anchor this sensorial delight in their memory, mentally represent the aroma, and back at the palace, pass on their delicious findings while dancing and waggling. They locate the precious nectar by situating themselves in relation to the sun and use other terrestrial visual cues, which they're capable of counting. And while the forager bees are intoxicated with subtle fragrances, others are involved in the manufacture of the perfectly designed nest. They don't do this in the automated way people have imagined, but rather by adapting to the geometric constraints of a space, which requires a mental image template of the desired outcome. Then, when the time comes to build a new nest, some of them become daring. These Magellans of the air prospect even the smallest cavities, assessing every detail. Back at the colony, they disclose their findings. Then the debate begins in the land of honey. With varying degrees of intensity, each bee broadcasts the location it would choose, and the final decision is based on the intrinsic superiority of the winning site, evaluated many times by several hundred individuals, a simple and effective model of democracy. And what can be said about bees' extraordinary learning abilities? That they exceed the wildest hypotheses. Not only can bees copy their peers, but they can also improve upon observed behaviours. Mathieu Lihoreau even discusses the probable existence of consciousness in bees, since these hymenopterans have the ability to recognise oneself as distinct from another entity, to plan, to recall specific events, and to take on the perspective of other individuals. Through this richly documented book, Mathieu Lihoreau delivers a vibrant tribute to insects, showing that the world of miniature beings should envy nothing in the world of giants. Jessica Serra. Prologue. What is a bee? Have you ever observed an insect? I mean, really observed one. By approaching it carefully, then watching it for several seconds, without disturbing it. Did you wonder what was going on in its head while you were watching it? Was it afraid? Did it carry on as usual? Did it even notice you? Like us, insects have organs that enable them to see, smell, and touch. They also have a brain that takes up almost the entire volume of their head. But unlike our brain, theirs is tiny. Reasonably, it makes us wonder what purpose it serves and how it works. Do insects have intelligence? Do they feel emotions? Are they conscious beings? Are they creative? I've been studying these questions for about 15 years. My relationship with these small invertebrates that have a head, thorax, abdomen, six legs, and almost always wings got off to a rough start, however. I mistreated them at first. As a child, I lived in a house with a yard. Like many young children, I developed the habit of tasting everything I found on the ground. Often, I would catch ants. Other times, it would be ladybugs. This was much to the dismay of my parents, who fed me well. Then, as I grew up, I started playing war. I besieged anthills with my plastic soldiers and captured their ant leader. At that point, I had no idea that these insects have an immense devotion to their queens, protecting them at all costs and not hesitating to sting or bite any intruder trying to approach them. Later, I wanted to tame them, I would put ants in an empty jam jar and pierce holes in the lid to make sure they could breathe. Then I would add twigs to keep them from starving and firebugs to keep them company. Unfortunately for the latter, ants can be very aggressive, and they need animal protein to feed their larvae and reproduce. When I grew up, I learned to love insects. It was at university that I discovered ethology, the science of animal behaviour. During practicums, we would watch videos of animals with the task of writing down everything we observed in an attempt to understand their behaviour. How many times did a young herring gull have to beg its mother for food to get a fish? How long would it take for Canada geese to decide to stop grazing on grass and look up to watch for predators? These videos were endless, but they sparked a vocation in me. Little by little, I began to see the animals around me differently. I first tried to photograph birds, but as my camera's memory card filled up with failed shots, I realized that it was much easier to take great photos of insects. A bumblebee, for example, can remain perfectly still for several dozen seconds while foraging from a flower, its target 2 centimeters from its antennae. Crane flies, tipula, are totally serene when sunbathing on a wall. Sure, I found insects to be photogenic, but not so photogenic that I wanted to spend my life studying them. Rather, I saw myself working with more charismatic animals, like great apes or whales. After all, the bigger the animal, the bigger their brain, and the smarter they must be, right? But this shift didn't happen, and I'll try to explain why my path was inevitable. I was introduced to research by my ethology professor. I didn't give much thought to the work I might be doing with him. I just needed an internship and a good grade. Alain Lenoir had spent his career studying chemical communication in ants. With him, I dissected hundreds of ants and analysed their scents using techniques borrowed from physical chemistry. Footnote: gas chromatography is used to separate molecules in a compound by vaporization. It's often used with mass spectrometry to then identify the molecules by measuring their mass. I wasn't studying behaviour or chimpanzees, but after several weeks of work, I was able to conclude that French ants had a different scent than Spanish ants, even though they were the same species. Since I hadn't read the scientific literature in detail, which one should always do before tackling a research question, I wasn't aware that I hadn't discovered anything novel. In most ant species, members of the same colony have the same scent, and this is partly determined by the many genes they have in common. Therefore, ants from geographically distant colonies, for example, on either side of the Pyrenees, are also genetically and olfactorily distant. Despite my stating the obvious, Professor Lenoir seemed satisfied with my work and encouraged me to continue in this direction. I did so with great enthusiasm, and that's how I came to be fascinated by the personality of cockroaches, how flies vote, how bumblebees navigate, how bees learn, and many other aspects of the private lives of insects that I relate in the chapters of this book. Today, I'm an ethologist. I study the intelligence of insects. Still not great apes or cetaceans, but it's a great pleasure to encounter a world that's paradoxically still largely unknown to us. We often marvel when looking up at the sky and wonder what might be up there and whether our existence has any meaning. Footnote: when I wrote these lines, the media was abuzz, reporting the French astronaut Thomas Pesquet's departure for his second stay on the International Space Station. Lowering our eyes to the ground can also be a source of wonder and can teach us a lot about our world, as well as about ourselves. Until very recently, insects were considered to be devoid of any form of intelligence, or, as the French philosopher and scientist René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, proposed to be animated by mere reflex mechanisms. We now know that all animals are endowed with certain forms of intelligence, and that these evolve as the species evolves. Insects are no exception. They have an extremely rich cognitive repertoire that is sometimes puzzling to us. And this is all the more remarkable because their brains are ridiculously small compared to ours. This mental sophistication isn't the fruit of an isolated researcher's, my own, imagination, but that of thousands of rigorous and independent scientific observations reported by hundreds of people for over a century. In this book, I'll describe the different forms of intelligence identified in insects and discuss their limits. I'll mainly discuss species that have been observed very closely for several centuries and that I know well, bees. But what is a bee? While the Western honeybee, Apis mellifera, which has been domesticated since antiquity, often tends to steal the show, bees include nearly 20,000 species and are the cousins of wasps and ants. This clade includes all species of honeybees, 8 species that are also used for their wax, propolis, and crop pollination, bumblebees, 250 species, some of which have also been domesticated for pollination, stingless bees, 500 species that, as their name implies, do not sting, and thousands of species of solitary bees that are generally given less attention, but whose importance is crucial to our environment. This book is not an exhaustive list of everything we know about these bees. For that, I advise you to read the works of my fellow researchers, or practical guides for beekeepers. This book is more a collection of scientific advances, anecdotes and reflections on bees' intelligence and on the ethologist's profession in the 21st century. Many of these discoveries have been made with bumblebees. Although less well known than honeybees, bumblebees are social bees and very common in gardens. They're round and hairy, and they're often viewed affectionately. They're easy to raise in shoeboxes, and within just a few years can be used as a model species for studying bee behaviour in general, similar to how laboratory rats are models for studying mammals. Footnote: bumblebees offer many advantages for research. They're domesticated, live in small colonies, aren't aggressive, and can be tested in the laboratory year-round. 3 species are generally used. The buff-tailed bumblebee, Bombus terrestris, in Europe. The common eastern bumblebee, Bombus impatiens, in North America. And the Asian bumblebee, Bombus ignitus, in Asia. They're also widely used for pollination because, unlike honeybees, bumblebees are able to pollinate by sonication, also called buzz pollination. They do this by vibrating their flight muscles to remove and collect pollen from flowers, pollinating them in the process. This form of pollination is necessary for the reproduction of many crops, such as tomatoes and eggplants. The team I lead in Toulouse, France, is dedicated to studying their intelligence. To better understand these insect psychology, we must try to project ourselves into their world as we know it, or rather, as we imagine it. This is what ethologists try to do every day. Until proved otherwise, bees don't talk to us. They can't explain to us what they feel or what they understand about a situation. If they tell you one day, you'll probably have a Nobel Prize coming your way. And while we're beginning to be able to translate human thoughts into words, thanks to brain imaging and artificial intelligence, we're still far from being able to decode insects' thoughts. I'll therefore try to immerse you in the world of these creatures by relying on experiments that have allowed me and many other researchers to decipher different aspects of their behaviour and to depict, little by little, their inner lives. An additional difficulty with beings so genetically distant from us is that their sensory system is also very different from our own. Their organs that are equivalent to our eyes, ears, nose, mouth, and fingers have capabilities that are foreign to us. The world of insects is therefore largely invisible to humans. The German biologist and philosopher Jakob von Uxkull, 1864-1944, described this sensory space as a soap bubble. When we try to enter an animal's bubble by using our imagination, our surroundings are transformed. Elements that were visible to us disappear as we enter the bubble, and others become more salient because they have an important biological significance for the animal. For example, I live very well without distinguishing the scent of a daisy from that of a dandelion, whereas this ability is vital for a bee. The bee's bubble allows it to smell the difference. On the other hand, I imagine that bees are unable to distinguish one of Mozart's symphonies from a Beatles hit. It's our human bubble that allows us to hear the difference. So then, what is a bee's bubble like? What information does a bee get from its environment, and how does it use that information to make intelligent decisions? I'll answer these questions based on findings from scientific research. Everything you'll hear is true, or at any rate, these experiments have a probability of being wrong less than 5% of the time. Footnote. By convention in biology, a result is considered significant, true, when a statistical test yields a probability of less than 5% that the result is false. If the probability is greater than or equal to 5%, the result is not significant. 1. A poor sense of direction. This might be the case with you too, but I have no sense of direction. I always get lost wherever I go. Sometimes this annoys those around me. Again, are you doing this on purpose or what? Even my 5-year-old daughter criticizes me, which is embarrassing. But unfortunately, I'm not doing it on purpose. Let me explain. I spent my childhood in Tours, France. During those years, I passed the same buildings, the same streets, and the same squares hundreds of times. All of these places are perfectly familiar to me, but I have no idea how to get to any of them, or in which direction I should go when I leave some place. Yet the city centre was built according to an irrefutable logic. It's bounded by two rivers, the Loire and the Cher, with several perpendicular thoroughfares built between the waterways. This construction was an unfortunate consequence of the destruction the city suffered during the Second World War, but nevertheless, it's useful for getting one's bearings. Historic monuments such as the cathedral, the castle, and the ruins of the basilica tower over most of the other buildings in the city, creating visual cues that make it possible to orient oneself from a distance. Despite an urban design that is conducive to efficient travel from place to place, I often get lost in my hometown, even when going to places regularly visited by tourists. What is perhaps the most annoying is that my poor ability to navigate isn't specific to Tours. It affects me everywhere I go, in every city I've ever lived in, whether large or small, a modern metropolis or an old town with winding streets. I can't do anything about it. Fortunately, today's phones are equipped with GPS. I still have a hard time figuring out where I am, but I've stopped missing appointments and flights due to getting lost. All I have to do is scrupulously follow the route my phone shows me, only lifting my eyes from the screen to avoid obstacles in my path. So I make do with my problem and never really thought to wonder how it came about. That is, until the day I became interested in bees. Unlike me, bees have a reputation for being excellent navigators. Yet a bee's brain contains about 100,000 times fewer neurons than mine, and their life expectancy, during which they learn to navigate, is less than 0.1% of mine. So how is it that these creatures get lost much less often than I do, without even the assistance of a smartphone? Some insects have navigational abilities that far exceed our understanding. You probably already know about the huge migrations of monarch butterflies that cross North America to escape the Canadian winter for the warmth of Mexico. Year after year, these orange and black clouds invariably follow the same path, even though they represent successive generations of butterflies. Or perhaps you've heard about the gigantic swarms of migratory locusts that fly over the African deserts in search of green grasslands. Footnote: locusts and grasshoppers have haunted people's consciousness since the Bible identified them as one of the 10 plagues of Egypt. Today, climate change favours their gregarious behaviour and invasive propensities. Some dragonflies even have the ability to cross the Indian Ocean to reach Africa and the Middle East from India. Impressive indeed, but many insects navigate in a way that resembles our own. Among nest-occupying species such as bees, ants, wasps, and many others, navigation involves learning to move from a fixed point, the nest, to nearby sites of interest, such as a food source or breeding area. It's similar to our routine of going from our home to our workplace or shopping areas. But for a bee that forages on a tree in bloom, getting the right orientation is a matter of life and death. Any failure to get from the nest to the tree, and then from the tree back to the nest, makes the bee vulnerable to an excessive expenditure of energy, a lack of food, the risk of being caught by a bird, or acute stress due to prolonged isolation from its colony. Studying these insects shows us that it's possible to develop extremely efficient navigation systems with very little information and few neurons to process that information. So how do they do it? In a bee's head. To better understand the navigation challenges that a bee has to resolve, let's enter a world far different from our own. Almost all species of bees, whether small or large, wild or domesticated, solitary or social, live in a nest. Footnote: most bees are solitary, meaning that a fertilized female bee is responsible for raising her larvae alone. Different levels of sociality are identified when several females cooperate to raise larvae. In the most social species, eusocial, such as the western honeybee, labor is divided between the adults, queens and males, who produce new larvae, and the non-reproductive adult females, workers, who care for the colony. Footnote: only a handful of species do not build nests, but lay eggs in the nests of other bee species, thus providing their larvae with shelter and warmth, an act of parasitism that earns them the name cuckoo bees. Among these bees, the adults who raise the young, larvae, must learn to forage in order to feed them. Larvae in particular need a lot of the protein and lipids contained in pollen to grow into adulthood. The adults, which are mostly females, mainly need the sugars contained in nectar to acquire the energy necessary for domestic tasks. Reproductive females also need protein to develop their reproductive organs, ovaries, and produce eggs. Therefore, foraging is a daily task for a bee. At first glance, it might seem straightforward. To our human eyes and nose, the flowers bees visit appear to be very colourful and fragrant. It's tempting to say that sight and smell should be a sufficient guide. But if we try to put ourselves in a bee's head for a few seconds, it's soap bubble, as von Uxkull said. We can see that foraging is much more complex than that. This exercise requires a bit of imagination. On the one hand, you have to see the world in a very big way, through a pair of compound eyes. You fly through your environment by vigorously beating your wings, feeling it with your articulated antennae, and tasting it by using your legs and proboscis, all while...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?